a walk. It is, I decide, the perfect suggestion. No noise, no smells, no unnatural light, lots of fresh air. There will be small talk, I suppose, but I'm getting used to Wally's small talk, even becoming fond of it. I can't today, I say, handing over Alfie's lead. On Thursdays, after work, I visit my mother. Then I have dinner with Rose. Your mother? Wally looks bewildered. But I thought you said your mother died. I said she overdosed, I reply. I never said she died. As soon as the automatic doors slide open at Sun Meadows, the smell of casserole and urine starts to seep out. It's a malodorous, tacky smell that clings to me, even hours after I've returned home, showered, and washed my clothes. Tragically, it is also now my mother's scent. Once my mother's scent had been talcum powder and toothpaste and laundry detergent. Cleanliness, godliness, and all that, she used to say as she hummed around the house. I remember having to hold my breath when I was in the room with her, particularly when she bent down to kiss me at night. One day she asked me why I was holding my breath, and I told her, "Your smell makes me feel sick." Mum had looked sad then. "I'm so sorry, baby," she'd said. "I had no idea. If you'd prefer I didn't hug you." "It's okay," I'd said, shaking my head. "It's worth it." At the reception desk, a woman I don't recognize smiles vaguely at me before returning to her paperwork. Security isn't very tight at my mother's establishment. I sign the visitor book, take a badge, and walk past the elevator, which has been screened off and bears a handwritten sign saying "out of order," no E. Fine by me. Elevators make me claustrophobic anyway, and smells seem magnified in them, particularly if I'm sharing the space with other visitors. I take the stairs. At the top, a man in a brown dressing gown pushes a walker down the corridor, scanning the floor as if looking for something. "Hi, Fern," one of the nurses says. It is Onab, whom I have determined to be one of the best nurses when it comes to Mum's personal hygiene and state of mind. "Your mother is in her room. She is having a good day." A good day, I have learned, can mean a vast range of things. It can mean Mum is happy to see me and will attempt conversation, or it could mean she is quiet and doesn't say a word. She is rarely aggressive or combative, and I'm grateful, because apparently that isn't always the case with people in this ward. Mum's door is ajar, and I knock lightly, then push it open. Mum is in a wheelchair in the corner, dressed in a pair of grey trousers and a white blouse that is turning a little yellow. Her hair has been brushed and is pinned back, which makes it look very grey around the temples. She's even wearing shoes, the black Velcro ones with white socks underneath. It does indeed appear to be a good day. "Hello, Fern," Teresa says. Teresa is Mum's new speech pathologist. She was 27 years old last time I asked. She has a thick brown ponytail, a sing-songy voice, and lots of ideas about ways to improve Mum's speech. Today, for example, there is a machine beside Mum's chair which is attached to a long cord. At the end of the cord is a flat, circular object that hovers over Mum's head. "What's all this?" "Transcranial magnetic stimulation," Teresa says. "We did it last week too. Your mother is responding very well to it. Watch." She holds up a flashcard showing a picture of an apple. "Apple," Mum says. "Now this one." Teresa holds up a flashcard of a lion. "Lion," Mum says. I am impressed. Because of Mum's brain damage, speaking is hard for her now. Usually she pauses before each word as if gathering strength, and then her mouth stretches wide around each syllable. Even with all the effort, her pronunciation is hollow-sounding and requires extreme concentration to understand. But these words come out remarkably clearly. Mum looks at me. "Puppet," she says, with painful slowness. Mum started calling me Poppet after the overdose. I think it's because sometimes she doesn't remember my name. Mum had never used affectionate nicknames for us before. But a lot of things have changed about Mum. She smiles more now. She is easily delighted. reminding me of a much older lady or a younger child. She's actually very good company most days. Mum's overdose happened 16 years ago. She took the pills in the evening, and Rose and I didn't even think about it when she didn't get up in the morning. Mum had never been a morning person. At midday, we helped ourselves to lunch. In the afternoon, we toyed with the idea of waking her, but Rose was nervous about upsetting her. She had a point. Mum was always cranky when we woke her up. It was 9 that night when we finally knocked on Mum's door. By then, she'd been in a coma for hours. Too many hours, they told us later. I called the ambulance because Rose was mute with shock. It was perhaps the only time in our lives when I was the one to step up in a moment of emergency. We found out later that Mum had overdosed on Valium and alcohol and her brain had been irreparably damaged. A few weeks later, Mum was moved to a permanent care facility and Rose and I bounced around foster homes until we were 18. Well, Teresa says in her sing-songy voice, I think that's enough for one day, Nina. You should be very proud of yourself. You should, Mum, I agree. I haven't heard you sound so clear in years. Teresa beams. If she continues to improve at this rate, she'll be speaking in full sentences by the end of the year. I can't wait to have a good old chit-chat with her, hear all her stories. Teresa removes the round thing from Mum's head and starts fiddling with the machine. Mum looks at me.
Where you sister?
Mum asks this every time. I'm not sure if it's because she doesn't remember that Rose never visits, or if she just hasn't given up hope. In the early days after her accident, it had been a requirement that our various foster parents bring us for weekly visitation. But the day Rose turned 18, she stopped coming. Mum unsettles me, she said when I asked her why. It must be one of those things I don't understand, because I never feel unsettled by Mum. To the contrary, 1 hour of unthreatening, halted conversation is one of the most settled parts of my week. Rose is in Europe, I say. Mum's eyes widen, which means she is interested. I know, I say. She's gone to visit Owen. He's taken a job there this year, and Rose is visiting him for 4 weeks. I'm grateful that today I don't have to lie about Rose's whereabouts. Often when I tell Mum that Rose isn't coming, her eyes fill with tears. Her emotions are unpredictable since her overdose, happiness to tears in an instant. I wish Rose would just come in and visit.
Owen?
Mum frowns.
Europe?
Yes, he's taken a job there, I repeat. Anyway, Rose is just visiting him. She will be back at the end of the month. Mum doesn't reply. Sometimes I am sad that Mum doesn't say much. Sometimes, like Teresa, I'd like to have a full conversation with her and see what she has to say. Sometimes she seems so frustrated by the fact that she can't talk, she clenches her fists and grinds her jaw. Other times she seems like she's made her peace with her disability and just sits there and lets my chatter wash over her. During those times, I have to admit, I like the fact that I can talk and talk and never have to worry about making eye contact or talking too much or missing any social cues. It's probably the only place in the world where I feel like I can do that. That, I suppose, is what mothers are for. I have some news, I say to Mum on a whim. It feels good because I never have news. Mum's eyes widen again. I've met a boy, I say. And finally, I get the gasp I've been waiting for. When I arrive home from Sun Meadows, Wally's combi van is parked in my parking spot. It looks distinctive among the maroon sedans and white Toyota Corollas, and it adds some character to the place. I reach the sliding back door and pause a moment. I don't know the proper greeting when arriving at someone's van, so I knock loudly and wait. Hello, Wally says, poking his head out of the driver's side window. Alfie sits happily on his lap.
Did you have a good visit with your mum?
I did. I go around to the passenger door of the van and get in. Alfie immediately leaps across the seat and lays his head on my lap. So, tell me more about your presentation. Who did you present to?
A group of investors. They're the same guys who gave us the money to start up Shout.
What is this idea? Another app? He nods.
It's a social prompter called follow-up.
I scratch behind Alfie's ears.
What is a social prompter? Basically, you enter all your invitations and engagements into the app, and it spits out communications that you can send via text, email, WhatsApp, or whatever platform you use. For example, if you receive an invitation to lunch that you want to decline, you can click on lunch and regular or one-off and business or pleasure, then press go. And the app will give you an appropriate response. Like,
he fiddles with his phone, then begins to read the screen.
No can do, I'm afraid. I don't do Mondays. Or, would love to, but I'm slammed next weekend. Sounds like it will be a ripper. Or, have a great birthday. Wish I could be there, but I'm going underground till I get through this busy period at work.
I look at the responses in wonderment.
I still have a lot more coding to do. Eventually, we'll be able to personalize it with the person's name, the event, follow-up excuses if they change the date, auto phone calls to give you an excuse to leave midway through an event, and also phrases to use if you are confronted by the person in real time. You'll be able to give it instructions to accept an invitation now, but decline on the day saying you have an illness. It will also remind you what your excuse was for future communications with that person, so you don't go making any gaffes.
Wow, I say. To have these turns of phrase at my fingertips? To not have to ask Rose or agonize over a response for hours? That would indeed be an app I would be willing to pay for. It's genius.
I think it will have a market. And now that we have investors, I've got work to do.
So, no more freelancing?
Not for the moment, no.
I consider this. Is this cause for celebration?
I think it might be.
A small smile comes to his lips.
But how should we celebrate?
Usually I celebrate by reading, but that's not really very sociable. Wally frowns.
I often reward myself after a day of work with a few games of Fortnite, but like reading, it's kind of a solitary endeavor.
We drift into silence as I ponder alternatives for celebration. After a short time, I notice Wally is staring at me. Right, at me.
Staring competition? I ask eagerly. Actually, I was wondering if I could kiss you.
I giggle. Again. This time I can't even blame the orgasm. That night, as we make love, I don't think about getting pregnant at all. Not once. I see him under the surface of the water. His hair fans around him like a halo. He's struggling. I hold tighter. Just a little bit longer, I think. It's almost over. When I do let go, he is slow to rise to the surface. He's bloated. And unnaturally white. Limp. His eyes and mouth are open.
I jolt awake.
Fern?
Fern, wake up! You're having a nightmare.
I'm in my room. It's quiet, as usual. But something is different.
Wally shakes me. Fern?
I'm awake, I say.
Are you all right?
Wally hovers over me. It's hard to make out his features in the dark room. I nod.
Are you sure? It sounded like you were having a nightmare.
Yes, I say. I just have them sometimes. Wally lies back down. He scooches up close behind me, so we are a pair of crescent moons. He throws an arm over me. The weight and warmth of it is a surprising comfort. I focus on enjoying it while I steady my breath. On this night, sleep comes surprisingly fast. In the morning, when I open my eyes, I am looking at Wally. His eyes are closed, and his long black eyelashes lightly touch his cheeks. My eyes drift down to his shoulders, his chest. He has a hairy chest, with a freckle just above his left nipple. His body is definitely on the slender side, particularly his legs, which are dangerously close to skinny. But his arms and chest are shapely and muscular, and I admire them curiously. Until I lurch upright.
Shoot!
Wally jolts awake.
What?
He scrambles around the bed looking for his glasses.
What's wrong?
I slept in.
He pushes his glasses onto his nose. What time is it? 7:07 a.m., I say, scrambling out of bed. I haven't slept in for years. My body is my alarm clock, and it wakes me every morning without fail between 6:10 a.m. and 6:30 a.m. Without fail until now. The fact that my body has failed me is unsettling enough without the other unsettling things I'm starting to register. Like the fact that I'm dressed in last night's clothes. Partly dressed. I'm not wearing a top or bra, but my skirt is bunched up around my waist and I am still wearing socks. My skin and teeth feel grimy. It takes me a few moments to realize that not only did I not undress properly before bed, I didn't brush my teeth or wash my face or apply lotion to my shins or anything. I did none of it. And now it's after 7 o'clock a.m. By now I should be in downward dog on my yoga mat in the living room. You have to go, Wally, I say. Why? He says, at the same time as there is a knock at the door. His eyebrows rise. Are you expecting someone? It's probably my neighbor. She likes to come over and read me the bylaws of our building. I locate my bathrobe and wrap it around myself, and Wally heads toward the bathroom. Alfie is at my heels as I fling open the front door. I only have a second to register Rose before she catapults herself into my arms. Rose, I choke. What? Normally I don't mind when Rose hugs me, but today there is something strangling about it. What are you doing here? Rose lets me go, and I notice she'd managed to hug while balancing a box in one hand. I missed you. Rose pushes past me into the flat. Why are you home early? I ask, closing the door. Aren't you pleased to see me? Rose places the box on the table. Don't answer that. Just sit down. I brought donuts. Rose sets the box on the table and opens the lid, demonstrating that she has indeed brought donuts. It's odd. Rose doesn't eat donuts very often because of her diabetes. I, on the other hand, eat a lot of donuts. Often, Gail brings a box of them into the library, and while everyone else stands around deliberating whether or not to have one, I am happily helping myself to thirds. Sit, Rose repeats. I look at my watch hesitantly. I have to go to work, Rose. I'm already late. What time do you have to be at work? 10, and I haven't done yoga yet. I expect Rose to ask me why, but she is obviously distracted. It's just after 7, Fern. You have time to catch up if I drive you to work. Reluctantly, I take a seat at the table. The moment I'm seated, the bathroom door opens, and Wally comes out. Hi there, he says. Rose looks at me. She looks so baffled I almost laugh. Rose, this is Wally, I say instead. Wally, this is my sister Rose. Wally extends his hand. Good to meet you, he says. Though I must point out that my name is in fact Rocco. He shoots a reprimanding smile at me. Rose continues to stare at him. It's strange. Normally Rose is so poised, so polite. She always has the perfect response to everything. Today she seems like the sister who doesn't know how to behave. Pleased to meet you too, Rocco, she says finally, taking his outstretched hand. She holds it for longer than appropriate. Maximum of 3 seconds, she'd always told me, and stares at him in a manner I would have considered rude. You look familiar. Have we met before? Wally picks up his shoes from beside the door where he'd lined them up neatly the night before. Not that I recall, but you never know. This world is a small place. Anyway, I'll leave you two to catch up. Fern, I'll talk to you later. It is a statement, but he poses it like a question, rising in intonation at the end. In light of this, I decide to go out on a limb and answer it as one. Sure. Talk to you later. Wally gives me a little salute and lets himself out with his shoes still in his hand. It's so peculiar, I find I can't stop smiling. I look back at Rose, who is gaping at me. He slept here? Fern, you can't just invite a strange man into your home. He's not that strange. I wonder if she is referring to the salute. He's a stranger, Fern. We don't know him. Is he the one who drove you home the other night after bowling? I nod. In his van.
That's another thing, Rose says. I saw Mrs. Hazelbury on the way in and she's not happy about that caravan outside.
It's not a caravan, I say. It's a combi van. But Rose isn't listening.
What did you say his name was again? Rocco?
Yes, but I call him Wally.
What's his last name?
Ryan.
Rocco Ryan.
Rose frowns frustratedly off into the distance, contemplating that. You still didn't tell me why you came back from your holiday early. Is everything all right with Owen? A tiny smile comes to her lips.
Everything is perfect with Owen. We're back together.
Rose is beaming. I get the feeling that I should be excited, but I'm confused. Back together? But did you break up?
Well, no. Rose's smile fades. It's complicated. Suffice to say, I have been worried about the state of our relationship these last few months, but not anymore.
Her smile returns.
Now I'm more confident about it than ever.
I smile, still not totally understanding. So, where is Owen? I ask. Back at your place? She shakes her head.
He's got to finish the project he's working on, but he'll be back as soon as he can. In the meantime, we need some serious sister time. Just you and me and these donuts. What do you say?
She dives into the box and pulled out a chocolate iced donut for me. She has one too, after checking her blood sugar on her glucometer. When we are done, I shower and get ready, and then Rose drives me to the library. It's not until much later that day that I realize that Rose never actually explained why she was home early.
Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. It wasn't easy leaving Owen, but if there was even a chance that Fern was in danger, it was worth it. It sounds dramatic, I realize that. Just because she'd met a guy didn't mean she was in danger. But the statistics in this area are grim. 90% of all people with intellectual disabilities will be sexually assaulted in their life. 90%! Call me overprotective, but I'm going to make damn sure that my sister is going to be among the 10%. I have to admit it's helpful journaling all of this. And my therapist is right. The subconscious has a funny way of connecting things. Joy connects to fear, good connects to bad. And so, on a day when I'm feeling good about my decision to come home, guess who I find myself thinking about? Gary. Gary was Mum's boyfriend when we were 11. Mum's first boyfriend, or at least the first we knew about after Dad left. Gary was a welcome addition to our lives at first. A novelty, you might say. He was a PE teacher. He wore shorts and trainers every single day, even on the weekends. I remember wondering if he even owned other clothes. The best thing about Gary was that when he was around, Mum was nicer. Gary was affectionate, which was also a novelty. He used to give us bear hugs and shoulder rubs. It was strange being touched in this way by an adult. Sometimes I liked it, but most of the time it confused me. One time, as we all sat in front of the television, he picked up my legs and began to massage them. I wanted to ask him to stop, but Mum was there and she didn't say anything, so I didn't either. He tried it with Fern next, but she told him to stop. Fern could always get away with those things better than I could. One day, Gary took us swimming while Mum was getting her hair done. Fern and I were excited. I don't know if it was the swimming or just the idea of doing something so normal that intoxicated me. Fern loved the water. When we arrived at the local council pool, she dived into the open section away from the lanes and paddled away immediately. I wasn't as good a swimmer as Fern, and I got into the pool slowly and stayed close to the shallow end. Gary sat on the side the whole time, watching. When I ventured toward the deep end, he called me back.
"I promised your mum I wouldn't let you drown," he said, sliding off the edge and into the pool.
I still remember his arms circling my waist under the water and pulling me against him.
I remember his bare thighs pressing against mine. And I remember the distinct feeling that something wasn't right about it.
Relax, he whispered. Just relax.
It was the strangest thing. There were people everywhere, all around us, and yet I was entirely alone.
Fern. Rose gets me to work on time, just. After all the excitement of her surprise return, it is a relief that my morning at the library is uneventful. The afternoon, however, is another story. I am in the children's corner reading to a child who has refused to take part in the school holiday singing and dancing group. Too loud, she'd said, and I quite agreed, when I hear a shout from the other side of the library.
Get out of my face!
The little girl looks up at me worriedly. I share her concern. The voice is deep and guttural and doesn't sound friendly. It's most unusual to hear a voice like this in the library.
Stand back! Get the fuck away from me!
I get to my feet to try to locate its owner. I see a large man towering over Carmel. Carmel looks uncharacteristically unsure of herself. She holds out both palms toward him in a surrender gesture, but he doesn't appear to be backing off. I scan the area around them. A few people quietly vacate their computers, gathering in small groups closer to the door. Gail watches from the front desk, her ear pressed to the phone. I cross the floor quickly to stand beside Carmel. Up close, I can see the man is shaking and sweating. He appears to be in quite the state.
Excuse me, I say. Are you requiring some assistance?
He looks at me.
Who the fuck are you?
I'm a librarian, I say. The children, I notice, have stopped singing and dancing. The whole library is silent, which is unusual for this time of the day.
A librarian?
He seems surprised by this. I take it as evidence that he's found himself in the wrong place. Yes, you're in the Bayside Public Library. Where were you hoping to be?
I need my money.
His eyes look bizarre, large and black like a cartoon character's. He grinds his jaw and picks at his fingers. He is clearly agitated. In his right hand, he holds a pocket knife, the small sharp blade pointing outward. I'm sorry, but weapons aren't permitted in the library, I say. I'm going to have to take that. At first, he doesn't protest, but at the last moment he shifts, extending his arm with the blade. It narrowly misses my shoulder.
Fern, Carmel says quietly.
Hey, I cry. You almost got me.
Where's my money? He says. Do you have it?
We don't keep money on the premises, Carmel tells him. Her tone is sharp and authoritative, but he mustn't take well to it because he lunges forward, jabbing the knife at her. I pull her backward by her shirt and frown at the man. Careful! You could hurt someone with that. The man looks right at me for the first time.
Where's my money?
The man is sweating, panicky. He must be really worried about his money. It must be frustrating not knowing where your money is, I say. It ruins my entire day if I lose something, believe me. Most likely it will turn up. In the meantime, why don't you sit down on this beanbag and I'll read you a book? He doesn't sit, but I walk to the nearby cart anyway. A copy of Michelle Obama's new book is waiting to be reshelved. How about this one? You're lucky it's here. This one has a lot of reserves on it. He doesn't appear to be listening, but it's amazing what people pick up, even while distracted. People with ADHD, for example, retain information better if they read while walking or engaging in simple play. I open the book. When I was a kid, my aspirations were simple, I read. I wanted a dog. I wanted a house that had stairs in it, two floors for one family. The library has cleared out, I notice, as I read. Carmel is still beside me, a little too close, if I'm honest. The man continues to pick at his fingers. I notice they are red raw and make a mental note to recommend aloe vera once I finish reading. After 5 minutes, he finally slides into the beanbag. He rests the pocket knife on the floor beside him. I pull up a second beanbag. We are sitting like that when the police arrive. As they handcuff him, he says loudly,
"But we were reading a book."
I shove it between his handcuffed hands. "Keep it." When I turn around, Carmel is standing there. "I'll pay for the book," I start. But before I have finished talking, Carmel has enveloped me in a suffocating hug.
"That was very brave," Carmel says later, as we sit side by side in the stationary ambulance. Both of us are unharmed, but the ambulance officers have wrapped blankets around us in case of shock. I'd feel far more comfortable if I could get back to work in the library, but the ambulance officers and Carmel have been quite insistent.
"Do you think that man was on drugs?" I ask Carmel.
"Yes, I do. The police think it was methamphetamines."
Janet once told me that in her previous job, due to the location of the library, she had come across a lot of drug addicts. The library, being free and cool in summer and warm in winter, became a sort of refuge for them. People complained about it, apparently, but Janet was their biggest supporter. "The library is for everyone," she used to say, "but some people need it more than others." She told me about a young woman, barely a teenager, who died of an overdose inside that library. The girl was a regular, apparently. Janet said she was sad that the girl was gone, but happy that the library had been a safe place for her for so many months. She had attended the girl's funeral and erected a little statue in the garden for her. That was the kind of person Janet was. "I wish you'd had a chance to meet Janet," I say to Carmel. Carmel smiles.
"I heard you and Janet were close."
"I learned so much from her," I say. "Not just about books. She taught me about people, how to help them, respect them, and how to enrich their lives through books." Carmel looks at me. Her eyes, I notice, are a marbled blue with yellow edges.
"Perhaps you can share some of Janet's wisdom with me sometime. And your own, for that matter. It's clear that you are very good at what you do. Not to mention beloved in this library."
Beloved? I've never thought of myself as beloved before.
"Maybe I could even shadow you as you work, to see what I can learn?"
I frown. "Shadow me?
Follow you."
"Oh," I say. "With your cart?" She smiles.
"No, no cart."
I think about this for a moment, and then, it might be because of the kindly way Carmel is looking at me, I nod. Carmel looks pleased.
"Wonderful. And then, maybe you could shadow me? I could even show you how to use the printers and the photocopiers."
I sigh. "I understand that you are making an effort, Carmel, and you have shown interest in Janet, which I appreciate. But I cannot and will not learn the printers and the photocopiers."
Carmel laughs. "All right, I accept that," she says. "For now."
After work, I stand at my living room window waving at Wally. He is sitting in the driver's seat of the van, reading a novel, and it takes him a moment to notice me. When he does, he waves back. He doesn't come up, and I'm glad. I'm already overwhelmed by the day, and I know further interaction would push me over the proverbial edge. But I enjoy him being within sight, where I can wave to him whenever I want. It makes me feel content, this little interaction. My phone rings and I look away from the window. Rose's name is on the screen.
"I knew the name Rocco Ryan sounded familiar."
Her voice is high-pitched and excited.
"I googled him. He is the Rocco Ryan who founded Shout."
"I know," I say.
"Fern, it is a huge app, huge."
"I know," I repeat.
"You know?"
Rose sounds disbelieving. This irritates me. To think she would know more about my friend than I do.
"Of course I know. Wally told me."
A pause.
"Fern, do you know what Shout is?"
I roll my eyes.
"An app,"
I say. "Something to do with ordering drinks."
"According to the article I read, Rocco and his partner sold it in 2016 for $100 million. $100 million, Fern! The article also said that Rocco is one of the most promising computer programmers the world has ever seen. He was in Silicon Valley before he came to Australia. He's been compared to Linus Torvalds and Steve Wozniak. Apparently, people were lining up to work with him when they sold Shout, but then he just went off the grid. It was quite mysterious. People assumed he was living it up on a private island or something.
I glance around the room, noticing a spiderweb in the corner that I really must take care of.
Fern, your friend is a gazillionaire. Does that interest you even a little bit?
I sigh, considering her question. Does that interest me? I suppose it does. At the same time, of all the things I know about Wally, the fact that he is a gazillionaire, not technically an actual word, is the very least interesting. Not especially, I say, waving again at Wally through the window. As Rose starts to reiterate all the reasons I should be interested, Wally waves back. On Monday morning, Wally comes to my door to ask if I'd like to have dinner with him. It's Monday, I explain. I have dinner with Rose on Mondays. Wally leans against the doorframe, his gaze resting lazily over my shoulder. Tomorrow then? I have dinner with Rose Tuesday nights too. Wally narrows his gaze.
Do you dine with Rose on any other evenings?
Thursdays, I told you, remember?
Wally doesn't seem to remember.
He laughs. Then he stops.
Seriously?
Yes.
Every week?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I frown.
Why wow? I don't know. That's just a lot of dinners with one person.
Is it? Given the fact that married couples presumably have dinner together 7 nights a week, it doesn't seem like such a lot. Then again, Rose and I aren't married.
I guess I could cancel, I say on a whim. But even as I say it, I get a funny feeling. I don't think Rose would like to be cancelled on.
It's just one night. She's probably jet-lagged after her long flight anyway. I expect Wally to smile at this, but instead he gives me a funny look.
Who are you trying to convince, Fern?
Wally leaves, and I text Rose. Bizarrely, I feel nervous as I thumb the words onto the screen. Do you mind if I cancel dinner tonight? In a matter of seconds, my phone begins to ring.
Why are you cancelling?
Rose demands the instant I answer.
Well, it's just Wally asked if I wanted to have dinner with him.
Oh.
Rose is silent for a few seconds. It's just that I'd already defrosted the chicken.
Couldn't we have it tomorrow?
A sigh. But I've been looking forward to it all day.
Rose's voice has a different sound to it, slightly juvenile and whiny. A gnawing sense of unease tugs at me. At the same time, the idea of cancelling on Wally and having to explain this to him is enough to make me dig my heels in. I'm sorry, Rose. I need to cancel. This time, the silence on the other end lasts so long I wonder if Rose has hung up. Rose?
Have dinner with Wally, she says abruptly.
Her voice sounds funny. I open my mouth to ask if everything is all right, but before I can, she has ended the call. I forget about the Rose situation the moment Wally walks into my flat, 15 minutes early that night. I'm anxious about the fact that all I have in the fridge is sausages, yogurt, and puff pastry, but Wally quickly puts me at ease by ordering pizza, which we eat at my round table. It is most strange seeing my second chair hosting a guest. Normally, it is simply a storage space for my unread books. Rose Googled you, I say as we settle onto the couch afterward. She read an article that said you sold your app for $100 million.
Wally cocks his head thoughtfully. The article was accurate. That isn't always the case.
Wow, I say. You live economically for someone with $100 million. He laughs.
I don't have $100 million. I got my share of it. But I had a business partner and we had a number of investors who all got their cut. And a good chunk went to tax and our charitable organization for underprivileged children. But you're right, I do live frugally, considering my means.
Why do you work at all? He appears to consider this. After a moment, he shrugs.
What else would I do? Sit around counting my gold? Besides, working is important to a person's mental health.
I agree wholeheartedly with this. I can't think of anything more important to my mental health than my work at the library. How is your mental health? I ask. I mean, the last time you were working on an app, things didn't go so well for you.
This time it's better, he says, smiling. His gaze is still over my shoulder, but closer these days, almost touching my face. We remain like that for a moment, Wally smiling at me. Then Wally sits up straight.
Oh, I almost forgot. I've been meaning to ask you.
He reaches into his pocket and retrieves a folded-up piece of paper, which he unfolds onto his lap. It appears to be for a private health fund.
What's this? I ask.
Changing health insurance, he says, rolling his eyes. I've had to do a mountain of paperwork, and it appears I need an emergency contact person in the country.
He holds out the page to me, and I know what he's going to say before he says it. It's rare that this happens to me. Under the circumstances, I should feel pleased.
Would you consider being my person? Wally asks, holding out a pen. I clear my throat.
I would be delighted to be your person, Wally. Truly delighted. But I feel there's something you should know first. Something important.
Wally looks surprised, but he nods and sits back in his chair. All right. What is it?
I close my eyes. Take a breath. When I was a kid, I say, I did something terrible. Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. After that first time at the swimming pool, Gary touched me all the time. He said if I told Mum, she'd blame me, which I'd already figured out. Mum was mad enough with me already. I wasn't going to provide her with new reasons to hate me. It was frightening how many opportunities Gary found. Officially, Gary didn't live with us, but you'd never know it with the amount of time he spent at our house. He was often there even when Mum wasn't. And so, I stuck to Fern like glue. Safety in numbers, I figured. It worked to some extent. But if Fern took a shower, if she went to the bathroom, if she just wasn't paying attention, Gary would come and sit next to me. He was discreet. His hand could slide into my shorts or up my skirt without making a sound. I didn't make a sound either. No matter how much I wanted to, every time I clammed up, became mute. Sometimes he even did it when Mum was there. We might be in the kitchen or sitting around watching television, and he'd suggest we start a massage train. He'd be at the back, of course. I was always next, then Fern, and then Mum. Since Fern and Mum were in front, they couldn't see when he fondled my breasts and groped me. I think he enjoyed the danger of it. I couldn't figure out if I wanted Mum to turn around, or if I didn't. But even that was nothing compared to what Gary did when no one was around. The first time it happened was on a weeknight. We'd been watching television, and I'd decided to take a shower. I locked the door and put a chair in front of it to be safe. When I emerged, 20 minutes later, the house was quiet. As I crept to my room, I passed Gary sitting on the couch.
Your Mum and Fern have gone to the supermarket, he said.
My blood ran cold. Mum often had to do a late-night dash. She wasn't organized when it came to food. Fern often went along to make sure Mum didn't just come home with wine and cigarettes. And so, there were Gary and I, alone in the house for God knew how long. I was wearing just a towel.
How about I give you a proper massage, he said. Not just the shoulders.
That time I did try to protest. I said I was tired and wanted to go to bed.
Good, he said. Let's do it in the bedroom. It will be more comfortable.
No, I said, I really think...
You need to stop thinking, he said. This will help you relax.
He laid me down on my bed for the massage and did things to me that I didn't completely understand until I was much older. But I knew what he was doing to me was bad. And I figured, for him to do those things to me, I must have been bad too. Fern. It happened when I was 12. Wally is still smiling, but it's fading. His eyes are showing the first hints of confusion.
What happened?
We were camping. Billy and I were playing a game.
Wait.
Wally holds up a hand.
Who is Billy?
Mum had a couple of boyfriends while we were growing up. She had one named Gary, but he didn't last long, which was good because I didn't like him. Then she had one named Daniel. Billy was Daniel's son. We all went on a camping trip together. It was supposed to be a time for us to get to know each other better and bond.
Wally sits forward, his elbows resting on his knees. We did bond on that trip. It was fun having another person to play with.
Billy was really competitive. He spent most of that camping trip trying to hold his breath underwater longer than me. I'd read a book about free diving, so I knew how to fill up my lungs completely, how not to panic underwater. Billy couldn't get close to holding his breath for as long as I could.
What happened, Fern?
I wrap my arms around myself and start to rock. On the night he died, he was so frustrated. He wanted to stay under the longest, but he just couldn't do it. Every attempt was worse than the last. I looked up at Wally. And so, I helped him.
Helped him what?
My voice is the barest whisper. Helped him stay under the longest. I held him down.
Wally's face remains still. Too still. No, he says. No, you didn't.
I feel the first tears hit my cheeks. I thought he would pop up and grin at me and say how happy he was that he'd beaten my time. But he didn't. When I let him go, it was too late.
Wally is staring at me in horror. But you must have known that if you held someone under the water for long enough, they would drown.
I did know that.
I wring my hands and then press my eyes into them.
I did know that. An adult can drown in 60 seconds. That's what all the literature says. I held him under for 40. It was timed. I don't know how it happened. I would never, never.
What happened when you realized what you'd done? He asks.
Rose told me I couldn't tell anyone. She was worried I'd go to jail. She said we had to say that Billy got tangled in the reeds and drowned, or I'd get into big trouble.
This is why you're always worried about what you might do?
Wally takes a deep breath, then drops his head into his hands.
It's awful, he says. Unimaginably awful.
I nod. My face is wet with tears. I told you I can't be trusted, Wally. I'm dangerous.
He looks up, shakes his head. It was a terrible accident. But it was clearly an accident, Fern. You would never intentionally hurt anyone.
Wally slides closer to me and pulls me against his chest.
You'd never hurt anyone, he repeats. And for some reason, maybe because it comes from Wally, I almost believe it. To my great surprise, Wally doesn't cut me out of his life. I wait for it to happen, either immediately or perhaps in a phasing out type arrangement. But day after day, week after week, he shows up, at the library or my doorstep, with suggestions of dinner or an evening walk. It is unfathomable. It's the kind of loyalty you might expect of a lifelong friend or family member. It doesn't make sense that Wally has elevated me to such a rank when we've only known each other a few weeks. And yet, he has. And so, over the next month or so, I amend my routine to create space for Wally. Early evenings are spent together, apart from the evenings I spend at Rose's place. At the end of the night, Wally returns to his van and I go to sleep alone. We both prefer it this way, as it keeps our morning routines intact. And I make up for the late nights by taking naps in the secret cupboard at work every time I get the chance. For a few weeks, I am lucky enough to sometimes get to see Wally during the day, too, when he pops into the library here and there. Unfortunately, it's not long before he moves into a co-working space in the city and can no longer visit me at work. I miss him when he's gone. It's a curious feeling, missing someone. I feel it in my chest, a blend of butterflies and indigestion. I start to loathe dinners with Rose. And it's not just my recent preference for Wally's company.
Since returning from London, she's become unbearably interested in every mundane facet of my life, from what I had for lunch to who I sat with to what I dreamed about. So when Rose phones and cancels dinner one night, terrible food poisoning apparently, I feel only minimal guilt at my elation. Wally is in my doorway when Rose calls, and he appears equally delighted.
That's the best news I've heard all day. And I've had a pretty good day.
Why have you had a good day?
The video I made for follow-up has gone viral.
He leans against the door jamb. Wally and I spend a lot of time in my doorway. There's something about the no man's land of it that I like. If he doesn't cross the threshold, it doesn't count as a visit, and as such isn't a disruption to my routine.
Gone viral, I repeat. Viral means a lot of people have seen it, Wally explains. The connotation is that it has spread like a virus would.
Clever. It's so rare that newfangled slang makes sense to me, but this is the kind of slang I could easily get on board with. Having decoded this part of the conversation, I take another moment to process it in reference to his previous comment.
And the fact that Rose has cancelled is better than that?
He smiles, but it is almost as though there is a frown behind it. I have recently learned that this face means I have failed to understand something that he finds perfectly obvious. I know this because I asked him what the face meant and he confirmed my interpretation.
Seeing you is always the best part of my day, Fern.
I smile.
Let's skip dinner,
Wally says, crossing the threshold. And just like always, we are entirely on the same wavelength. In the morning, Wally is gone, but the side of the bed that he sleeps on has been disturbed in that way that says he's been there recently. Watching his side of the bed for a few moments before I start my day has become a part of my routine too. Then I move on to the usual routine: breakfast, coffee, yoga. I have just settled myself in lotus position when I notice the date on the calendar on my wall, and a thought comes to me. So clear and fast, it is as though it's been tucked just out of sight, just waiting to be retrieved. My period is 2 days late. According to Google, a period that is up to 5 days late is normal and a typical part of a healthy cycle. What's more, cycles can be influenced by a great many things: changes to routine, excessive exercise, and travel. This information is a great comfort to me. While I haven't traveled in recent weeks, I've certainly had my fair share of exercise, yoga, karate, sex, and changes to my routine, Wally, so those things combined would explain my late period. And so I spend the next few days carrying out my daily routine with almost painful precision, hoping this will rectify things. Before I know it, my period is 6 days late.
Fern, come and look at this, Rose says.
Rose is in the corner of IKEA, hovering by a white Billy bookcase, inspecting it with what feels like an inordinate level of scrutiny.
This will work, don't you think?
Rose continues to say something, but I can't hear very well because I have my earplugs in. I still am not quite sure how Rose managed to convince me to come to IKEA. She knows I don't like shopping, and IKEA, let's face it, is the mother of all shops. I do almost all of my own shopping online, and frankly, I don't understand why anyone would do anything else. Virtually everything, including IKEA, is available online, and pretty much all of the larger department stores offer free delivery and returns. And if there is an item I desperately want but can only get in a big shopping center, I ask Rose to get it for me. Ironically, it is exactly this logic that Rose used when convincing me to come.
I don't like shopping, I had whined when she asked me. Fern,
she put her hands on her hips.
You know when sometimes you ask me to go to the store to get you something?
Yes.
Do I go?
I roll my eyes.
Do I go? Rose repeats.
Yes.
I'm not asking you to understand why this is important to me. I'm only asking if you can do it.
And so, here I am, at IKEA. It smells like cinnamon rolls and meatballs, an eye-wateringly disgusting combination, and it's as bright as a summer's day. I'd wanted to wear my swimming goggles, but that would have meant a detour to my flat, so I'd settled for sunglasses.
What do you think? Rose asks, gesturing to the generic-looking bookcase as I lip-read.
I think I'd like to get out of here before I get a migraine, but I give the bookcase a cursory glance.
It's not very big, I say.
Rose frowns.
I'm sure they sell bigger ones.
I curse silently. If I'd only said I love it, we could be writing the number down and heading to the warehouse area. The one area of IKEA that I, if not enjoy, appreciate for its resourceful organization. Instead, Rose is wandering distractedly to another section of the store, looking for someone to point her in the direction of bigger bookcases.
Fern, she calls, come and look at this.
The store is uncomfortably full, and I have to push past several people to follow Rose. Everyone is saying excuse me and sorry and smiling at each other, but my head is starting to spin. How can so many people be buying bookshelves?
Let's just choose one and go home, I call after her.
She says something in reply, and I have to remove my earplugs to hear her.
What did you say?
I want to make sure I find the right one, she says. I don't want to rush into it.
We emerge from the crowd of people, and I make a beeline for a little wedge of space I spot next to a toddler bed and wrap my arms around myself. Even with my sunglasses on, the lights are making me woozy.
I was thinking white, but what do you think of this natural timber? Rose says, gesturing at the wooden frame of another set of shelves. And look, it comes with a matching lamp.
She lifts the timber lamp and it flashes directly into my eyes. If I didn't know better, I'd think my sister was deliberately trying to set off a sensory attack.
Rose, I say, I have to go outside.
Just one more minute. I want to look at the bedside tables. Then we'll go.
She takes my hand and pulls me back through the crowd. We pass several young couples arguing. A pair of twin toddlers bounce on a bed in frenzied joy as their heavily pregnant mother screams at her husband to control them. Rose continues to pull me, but when we come to a clear space, I plant my feet. Rose looks back over her shoulder.
Fern, what are you doing?
Nausea overwhelms me. I sink into an armchair and drop my head into my hands. Rose's nude ballet flats appear in my small field of vision.
Fern? I hear her exclaim. For goodness sake, I just want to show you one more.
I vomit on her shoes.
Here, Rose says, holding out a plastic cup of water. Drink this.
We are in the parents' room, on a chair designated for nursing mothers, which strikes me as ironic, all things considered. Rose is rubbing my back in rhythmic circles, saying shush and everything is going to be all right. From the moment I vomited, she'd taken care of everything, collecting a roll of paper towels from a sales assistant, cleaning everything up, waving away offers of help. She'd found me water and told everyone it was fine, her sister just wasn't feeling well. She seemed so serene, so in control. It reminds me why I need her so much.
Are you feeling better?
She asks after I have finished my water. I nod. A little.
What happened in there? She asks. Did it all get to be a little too much? Or was it something you ate? Maybe...
My period is 6 days late, Rose. Rose stops rubbing my back. After several beats, she says,
What?
I repeat myself. Rose takes a couple of steps away from me, then lowers herself into another chair.
Have you and Rocco been having sex?
I wonder why else she would think I'd be worried about my period. Yes.
And do you think you might be?
Yes, I say. I think I'm pregnant. Back home, Rose and I cram into my little bathroom. The pregnancy test sits flat on the bathroom vanity before us. One line is clearly visible, and a second, fainter line is starting to appear beside it.
Well, Rose says, holding her temples. You're definitely pregnant.
She takes a deep breath and sits on the toilet. I remain standing, leaning against the wall.
I wonder what Wally will say,
I say. Rose looks up.
You're going to tell him?
Of course. Rose looks startled, which is puzzling. I have a rudimentary understanding of common courtesy, after all. And the only times I have heard of people not telling the father of their baby that they are pregnant are in daytime television shows when the pregnancy is the result of an affair or a one-night stand. When the two parties are exclusively seeing each other, the custom appears to be some kind of excited announcement.
Surely that is the expected thing to do under the circumstances, I say.
Inform the father of the baby that he is going to be a dad?
Yes, Rose says slowly. If you're going to keep it.
She is quiet for a long time.
Is that what you were suggesting?
I'm not sure what I'm suggesting. The fact that I'd originally decided to have the baby for Rose feels like a million years ago. Back then, there was no Wally. The baby was nameless, faceless. Now, the baby is inside me. It is ours. And everything feels all at once, completely different.
What if I were suggesting that? I ask.
Rose closes her eyes for a short moment.
Do you really want to know what I think?
She opens her eyes. I nod.
All right. Honestly, the idea worries me. We both know you've had your difficulties in the past.
She doesn't say it explicitly. She doesn't have to.
What if something happened when you were with the baby? Babies are vulnerable, Fern. Bad things can happen, even by accident.
Rose sighs. She looks like she might cry.
The only possible way this could work is if you had a stable, level-headed partner. And Rocco isn't, is he?
I regret telling Rose about Wally's nervous breakdown. I'm not entirely sure how it happened. One minute we were eating chicken satay for dinner and talking about how the library was abolishing fines for overdue books. And the next, Rose knew everything. Her gift for getting information out of people is truly astonishing. Owen used to say she'd make a great interrogator.
Think about it, Fern. Rocco couldn't cope with some basic business pressure. He found it so stressful that he had to leave his country, abandon his whole life, and start a rudderless existence living out of his van. What would happen if he were presented with a real difficulty like disease or death? Or a baby that just wouldn't stop crying?
I open my mouth to answer.